My coming on, coming across.
Could you tell?
Oh, I should get the headset, I suppose.
So I can hear you.
Okay.
Oh, this. Maybe I don't. Yeah. Try without. Get to the agenda here. I keep bringing up the regular agenda instead of the work session agenda for some reason. Bear with us a minute, folks. We're still getting organized here. Good evening, everybody, from Gustavus City Hall. This is Mayor Taylor, and I'll call to order our work session for Monday, January 10. Sorry, we're a few minutes late here. And I'll start by reading the vision statement. We envision a distinctive community that prospers while and by protecting its natural resources, with a sustainable economy and infrastructure that assures public health and safety while promoting personal development and initiative, and where all members take social responsibility and actively participate in the decision-making affecting growth, development, regulation, and enforcement, and in which people retain a closeness with and caring for each other individually and collectively while working together to accomplish community goals and preserve community traditions. So we have a meeting agenda that's been posted, and on that agenda for our work session, we have coming up a city administrator work session report, and then we'll go through our general meeting agenda. And within that, we've got a COVID-19 discussion item on the general meeting agenda to go over. But I'd like to add a couple things to the agenda. I'm gonna call on Matt Davis in a minute here to give us his views on or of the tsunami tower. And then we also have another item that we've added on the marine facilities use agreement that we'll discuss towards the end of the work session, and with the idea of putting that on the general meeting agenda as well. So I see Matt Davis is online here, and I've asked him to join us tonight and speak on his issue about the tsunami siren. So, Matt, please proceed. We're welcome to the meeting, and we're looking forward to hearing from you.
Thanks, Mike.
Mayor Mike, I should say, you can hear me. Is that correct?
We can.
Okay, great. I think initially I'll just, I want to bring reference to something I just emailed about 40 minutes ago. If you're able to pull that up or have not, those of you on the council, that will be a good reference here for the topic at hand. So I guess, you know, my first question here, kind of going back to some of the email questions that I sent you folks already, and part of the project planning resolution, you know, is part four of the project planning, as far as the impacts and benefits checklist, still part of the project planning resolution, or has that been stricken from the proposal process?
Matt, I'm sorry, we were just working to get your email over to the clerk. So hang on a second, then we'll come back on that.
Sounds good.
I hadn't realized that it didn't go to the clerk, so. Okay, and that email has the map in it of the from the Alaska Division of Geological and Geophysical Surveys, a report on their investigations of the areas that were most at risk from the tsunami. Okay,
correct.
Matt, excuse me. How about repeating that question now so I got it straight here?
Sure. So, just to frame the context of this discussion here and my inquiry, you know, the tsunami tower siren has created an impact on my viewshed of my home, and it's something that I value greatly. It's one of the reasons that we bought our property and built a home there, was because of our view of the Fairweather Mountains. I looked at the original proposed location of the tsunami tower and from back in the summer, and determined that it would likely be, you know, just enough out of view, kind of behind some of the deciduous trees that are adjacent to the DRC, and kind of determined that there wouldn't be an impact to my property, any more than what the DRC already is. So when the completion of the installation occurred and the tsunami siren was not in the proposed location, and as a result is now greatly impacted my view of Mount Bertha and the Fairweather Mountains overall, I became extremely disappointed by that decision to move the tsunami tower without basically giving the public, the community, a chance to comment on it. I guess question one here is, why was the location change? And then from what I've been told, there were, a suggestion by a third party, one of the installers, et cetera, that suggested that location might be cheaper. And I think overall, just looking at the planning and development of this project, specifically in the project planning resolution, was part four, specifically the project impacts and benefits checklist, that's so well defined, and even more specifically, the line items that talk about neighborhood character and, most poignantly, noise or other environmental impacts, so this apparatus, which is created, designed to be extremely loud, extremely tall, were these impacts addressed during the planning and subsequent site selection? And why weren't they reconsidered with the what seems to be last minute change to the location?
Okay, I think I've got your question. I don't really have answers for all of it, I'd have to say. It wasn't a project that I worked on. It was developed during the last council's period. I was on the council, but it wasn't something that I had much direct work on. So I may not, I can't say I'm up on all the decisions that were made on it. The installation, as I recall, the decision to relocate it by, I don't know, a couple hundred feet or whatever that is, was to, primarily to reduce the cost of, the need to run electrical power all the way over to that. Yeah, it's a 220 volt system, as I recall. So this saved a bunch of trenching and put the tower adjacent to the little marine facilities tiny shop that we've got there, which also had to be powered. So it made for a more compact construction and siting for the tower. It has another, the location also gets the tower out of the sort of the middle of the harbor parking area. So in a way it's more out of the way, but I don't know that that was one of the considerations in deciding to move it. To my knowledge, I'm not aware of any further assessment of impacts with regard to the project. I'm sorry, I don't know if there were any more done. This is partly a state project and, you know, kind of a joint project between the state and the city. So I don't know that there was any further evaluation of those considerations, Matt.
Okay. And when you say a collaborative project between the state and the city, is it my understanding correct that it was basically just a state grant? So the state funded it, but yet the city handled and contracted the installers to complete the installation?
I think, you know, the state was, this was a state program to put tsunami warning towers up all over the state. Well, all over the coastal areas of the state. And so they had a major role in how it was done, and they provided the tower. They provided the contract, as I understand it, for the people who do the installation and check out on the tower. So that part would have been the state's. The city, I think, did per the grant handle the construction.
And did the state collaborate with the site development or site plan, site location, or was that specifically chosen by a representative of the city?
I think that was worked out. The original one was worked out between the city fire chief, Travis Miller, and the state. What involvement, or discussions there were with regard to moving it over? Well, there had to be some agreement on that because we were working their grant and we didn't want to do something that was going to void the grant. But again, I wasn't managing the project. I can't tell you.
Sure.
I could, maybe at this point, if you don't mind, I could ask Sol Martinez, the current chief, if he has anything to add to that, because he may be aware of aspects of that I'm not. He was interim chief at the time it was installed, as I recall. So Sol, would you have anything to add to that?
Unfortunately, I do not. The pool in place actually was already installed by the time I got there. So the decision was just before I got there. I'm not 100% sure when the decision was made, but as far as I know, the state or ICE FEMA provided the funding for the installation, but yeah, I can't really add much more.
Okay, thank you, Sol. Matt, so I guess that we're leaving you a little vague on the answers to that, and I'm sorry about that.
Yeah, I understand. You know, you and many members of the this year's council were not involved with the process of the installation and planning and design. You know, I guess my concern, just, you know, reading through the project planning resolution, you know, an answer to that question maybe can be provided from Tom or Karen. You know, is part four of the project investigation and development of the planning resolution, is that still part of the planning process for the city projects? Or is that, just reading through the document, you know, I'm no attorney, but, you know, is that still part of the process to look through that checklist and identify impacts?
I'm not sure about that. Tom, I think, has an answer to that and maybe some more comments. So I'm glad to have Tom chip in.
Thanks.
Thanks, Mayor. Actually, I don't have that resolution in front of me. And the way you're asking the question, I'm guessing that it's a selection criteria that's asking for public input. Is that correct?
It's stated as part 3, 4, 5, and 6, but part 4 and 5 are in red and stricken through of the project investigation and development section. But under part 4, you know, it remains intact. And in red is showing the project impacts / benefits checklist. And that's part of resolution CY 18-14, going back to 2018, I believe. You know, so that's a question you can get back to me on. And a question to just throw out there for future projects. You know, are we still asking these questions for city projects in the planning phase, you know, and I bring that up just because specifically this tsunami tower has, in my opinion, impacted the neighborhood character of my neighborhood. It definitely has a noise impact, right? You know, it is a safety device, but it is a noise, and in that sense, an environmental impact as well. And it's affected my property, my view shed, which to me is of great value. So, you know, kind of moving on, I guess, you know, because I understand you guys have some of the answers here and we're in a discussion, and it's not easy to pull up those concrete answers most immediately. So just kind of moving on to the discussion of the effectiveness of this apparatus, which I'll try to keep brief. You know, and first and foremost, you know, like, I was on the fire department for a number of years, both as an EMT firefighter, and I'm definitely an advocate for public safety and any apparatus that makes our community safer, stronger. But I tend to question the effectiveness of this apparatus, and I actually reached out to the tsunami warning center located in South Central Alaska, asked them some questions. They got back to me actually very quickly, and it was very informative. You know, so just to kind of bring you guys up to speed, and maybe you know a lot of this already, but this siren is based on the DART system, which relies on deep water buoy sensors as well as ocean level sensors to trigger this apparatus, you know, in conjunction with seismic sensors as well. But it specifically relies on basically ocean buoy systems, either deep water or ocean surface level sensors. Our nearest ocean level sensor, there's only one of them in our region, is in Elfin Cove. There are 3 deep water buoys, which are pretty far off the coast. You know, one is about 400 miles west of Vancouver. The other is about 400 miles west of Haida Gwaii. And the other is about 600 miles west of Juneau in South Central. And it's actually down at the moment. So where I'm going with this is these sensors, these very few sensors, in conjunction with sensors across the Pacific, are what triggers this apparatus to go off. So a landslide in Glacier Bay will not trigger it. A landslide on Chichagof will not trigger it. Potentially a nearer, massive seismic event could trigger a tsunami that gets past these deep water sensors, but then is only triggered by the ocean level sensor in Elfin Cove. So the overall effectiveness of this tsunami siren, I think is marginal at best. I would say I'm more of a proponent for improved communication in the community to where the emergency alert system can more effectively provide information in these scenarios, which has proven to be the case in the past. So that's just kind of, my opinion of this apparatus. So, but to continue down those lines, because I see this installation has detrimentally affected my property. Looking at basically the map that I just sent to the council members, and you may have in front of you now, or you do have in front of you now, which is produced by the DNR state. This is the tsunami inundation maps for Elfin Cove, Gustavus, and Hoonah. It's the maximum composite potential inundation extent for all scenarios, and the maximum composite flow depths over dry land in Gustavus. So what we're looking at, and you can zoom in on this map to amazing clarity if you've actually pulled up the link. We are looking at a very, very localized inundation event for all scenarios, says DNR, all scenarios, right? So the tsunami tower location itself is almost more at risk than 99% of the homes, including my own, in the entire city. I have to question the value of this installation, because it literally in our documentation provided by the state is showing us how little area is affected. And currently now it has ruined my view of Mount Bertha, something that was like one of the most amazing parts of our home. And I know we're very fortunate, my wife and I and our children, to have our home in Gustavus, in that place, that location in Gustavus, to have that view. But I'm at a loss that and I'll say this, it's, another council member pointed out that, I don't think anybody did this of will intent, ill intent. This was just an accident, maybe through a mistake of poor planning or a last minute change to save a little bit of money. But here I'm stuck with the consequences for how long, forever. I see this tsunami installation as a relic of an initial attempt at providing a safety instrument to some communities. And in some communities, I think they do have a great value. But in our community, I think based on the what the scientists have indicated as the extent of inundation for our community, it's doing more damage to myself, I guess, than as far as the safety I think it's providing. So I think my argument is clear looking at this map alone, that this location is a poor one. I think looking at this map, a far better location, and to speculate at times of year when people could be at risk, right? The best location, especially because this was a state collaboration, would be on Whale Island, or at least more near the dock. Imagine a ferry's in town, or the sport fishing, communities on the docks, and so. My opinion is this, and I think I've expressed it in my email, and I think I've been quite clear, is, we need to either relocate this installation to the original proposed location, which I would suggest is enough out of my viewshed to where I could be, made whole. I think it could provide the opportunity to provide a better assessment, a better plan, a better design, and relocate the tsunami siren to a more effective location in the community. And maybe that's the dock and you know, I can leave that up to people that are in that capacity. But at this point, you know, it's not going to work for me to leave that tsunami siren in the current location. And case in point, that's where I'm at.
Okay, well, I think I appreciate your careful discussion and complete discussion of several issues that you raise about the current location, whether it's the most effective location to serve the area of where the tsunami risk is the highest, which is primarily the boat harbor and the beach, mostly places that are below the tree line. According to the analysis that is shown on the map that you sent, which we got about 5-6 years ago, as I recall, when they did that. So I appreciate that discussion elucidation of your concerns about it. Do any council members have any questions to ask Matt about his concern?
This is Jim Mack. I don't have a question. I just have a comment, and we don't need to discuss this tonight, but you know, we don't have zoning in Gustavus, and it comes with a price. There's a lot of private land between Matt and the Fairweathers, and there's nothing to stop anyone from stockpiling junk cars there. So that's something they'll always think about there. And I'll keep it limited to that.
Right. That's something that's, is certainly relevant here. We don't have zone planning and zoning regulations like a lot of communities do, which might set limits for how high something could be or protection of view zones and so forth of existing properties. And my guess is that most of the community would resist having such regulation, at least at this stage in our the growth of our community. So that means that we don't have a process for evaluating something that, whether it's a private individual is wanting to build it on their property or the city. So that just doesn't exist in this community. And did we have those sorts of regulations, then it might have been addressed differently. But those regulations come at a cost for other values that the community has too. So thanks. Looks like Tanya has a comment or a question. Tanya?
Yeah, thanks. I don't have any questions for Matt. I just want to throw out a few more questions to city staff and any council members that might have answers. First of all, you know, I pulled up CY18-14, and it does indeed have all sorts of strikethroughs and red marks. So it seems like it's still in draft form. And so I'm curious, why is that? And it would seem like our resolutions that go on our website would be complete. So that's one question. And then also wondering if there was a planning document for this. I think it'd be great for us all to see what was considered, what were the impacts that were considered. And then I guess my last question is, when does the council talk about this? Are we going to discuss it now, or is this for a later time?
With regard to CY18-14, I noticed that's calendar year 18. So boy, is that a few councils back that maybe didn't come to a final version of that, or for some reason is posted like that. I don't know if Tom has any information on planning documents on this. Do we have something that's, if one of the council members, Tanya perhaps, wants to dig into this more, do we have some files relating to this, Tom, that you think would be helpful?
Do you have a file on this? So as I remember this project, the state reached out to the fire chief, talked about the program, for the tsunami sirens. And fire chief put together the package, and the package had some boilerplate resolutions and other documents that were converted into city documents. And my guess is the resolution language is a cut and paste out of those template resolutions. As far as the planning process goes, as I remember it, Travis brought this to the council. Mayor Cassapit was the only other person I was aware of that worked on the project, probably just in a manner of reviewing the proposal Travis had put together. And then that document was brought to the council. And I'm not sure whether the council looked into any of the issues that Matt brought up. Frankly, I don't remember that discussion. From there, we were looking at relocating it for the reasons you mentioned, Mayor. And we had two issues. One, that the DNR had not approved placement of the tsunami within the Cooperative Resource Management Agreement. So we reached out to them and filed for or asked for approval, and they amended the CRMA for that. And then we also had a discussion with the council, I believe it was at a work session, about what we were doing. So I don't know that there's any formal documents about that process. I don't remember everything that's in that that file, but it is available at City Hall. I can pull that tomorrow if any council members want to know any of the particulars. I can break that file out and see if there's any documents that could address any of those questions. That's the best I have, Mayor.
Thank you very much, Tom. Well, Tanya, I'm wondering if this is a project you'd like to look into a little more and perhaps have some more information you could bring to the council on options and the like. I think one pertinent thing here is going to be whether this is something that we can justify spending money, public money on moving. Does the public get sufficient benefit out of moving it if the cost is some thousands of dollars to relocate it, which I would expect to be. I think the installation cost was, well, somewhere between $5,000 and $10,000. I'm not certain what the total cost was because we didn't actually pay all of it. But Tanya, is that something that you think you could take on, or are there any other council members who are interested in looking into this and seeing if they're, you know, what our options might be?
I guess I'm not really interested in digging into everything that happened, but if it seems like it wouldn't be too hard to establish if the proposal went out that it was supposed to be in one location and that was shared with the public, and then the location changed with no input from the public, then I feel like we have an obligation to move it, because we messed up, especially if there's no other prior planning documents or any way that the public could have provide input on the location that it ended up being. So I don't know that we need to spend a lot of time on it. We just, if that's true, if the location changed with no public input, then I feel like we have an obligation to move it back. Thanks.
Thanks. Looks like Joe Van der Zanden has a comment or a question. Joe?
Yeah, I don't think I've ever talked with anyone that spoke favorably of that tsunami warning, either before or after the installation. But I know that to move it is probably going to be around $10,000. And I think Matt has a good point that there's no reason for it to be there. If there's any place where it's justified, it would be out at the beach. And if we are going to spend money on moving it, we should check into all the options of how it could go out there. And I don't think it needs to be on any 40-foot stick to be at the beach and warn people that are down there or people on boats. But that's just my opinion. Thanks.
It makes me wonder if the pole could just be a lot shorter. I think, does anybody else have any of the other council members wish to offer any ideas or thoughts on this at this stage? This is doesn't have to be by any means at the end of any discussion on this. We can keep thinking about what to do. So, Kyle?
Yeah, I agree with what Tanya said. I think if we mess this one up, we should fix it. And I personally would be willing to work on finding a solution to this.
Okay. I think the probably the answer is for people willing who are willing to work on this to put together a scoping document for a project. And just like we approach any other project, and then the council could address that, you know, whether to approve that scoping document or to modify it or some such. So I think that's probably our way forward. And if any of you need any help on, if you haven't done a scoping document before for a project, then I'd be glad to help you get started on that. So any other thoughts, comments? Okay, and Matt will keep you informed about where we are. I appreciate you spending the time to let us know how you felt about this and the background work that you did for it. So thanks a lot.
Thank you. Thank you, Mayor Mike. I just want to thank everybody for their time this evening. You know, on that note too, you know, we're a small community. I have certain resources, you know, that are available to me, whether it's heavy equipment or even just, you know, a helping hand. So if I can help in that effect, you know, kind of back to your vision statement that you spoke of earlier, back to the city of Gustavus's vision statement, you know, in that community helping effort, I guess, let me know.
Thank you very much. Okay, so I'll move on to let's see, back onto our agenda here. I'm on the wrong one here. Yeah, screen's far enough away that it's hard for me to read my old eyes. Sorry. I think the next item would be our city administrator's work session report. So, Tom, you're on.
Thank you, Mayor. Thank you and good evening, everybody. So the first item on my report has to do with community septic situation. This was sent out to the council last week, so they had an opportunity to review the material so that when I discussed it here at the work session, we would get some idea of how we might be able to address the situation. In summary, we have an issue with getting our septic tanks pumped out. And we currently use a third-party source out of Juneau. Folks give them a call. They get put on a list. And best case scenario, the truck is put on a ferry. It's brought over to Gustavus. And the truck has very limited capacity on the for the number of tanks it can service. The problem there is the reliability. I spoke with the service provider, and there's quite a backlog of folks who were not able to get their tanks pumped last summer, either for problems with getting the truck on the ferry or time for them to come out to Gustavus. It's not a real profitable run for them to do. They also do other communities that are rural and require this kind of service. So I was looking at what different possibilities there might be. I spoke with several people in developing some options for discussion. Elmer Obershard and Justin and Punch and Juneau Septic and the lightweight. And so what I have presented here are several different kinds of possible solutions. The first one is this truck that pumps the tank, separates the water, mulches up the compost and returns the water back into the tank so all the bacteria and the other beneficial components are there to service the septic system. This particular option has its complications to it. It's somewhat technical. It requires purchase of the truck. We have to figure out what to do with the compost, how it could be disposed of or utilized. I reached out to DEC for all of these options, but over the last 3 weeks, I have yet to get a return call, even though I've made several attempts to contact them. The particular truck here is a used version. You can see the price, $130,000. The link to the YouTube demonstration, I think, was very illustrative. It did a good job of showing how the process worked. It would allow us to handle our septic here locally. We wouldn't be reliant on the ferry or a third party service provider. The product could be used for multiple purposes. The nitrates, I understand, are super beneficial to vegetation. There are even examples of where it's combined with other compost and used for gardening. Another option is where we ship our septic to Juneau and it's handled there. That approach, there's a couple of options that I've illustrated here. One is where we would set up a tank farm, say over by the DRC. We would utilize these tanks that are on skids. We would rotate those through the lightweight. We would have a couple on site and a couple in route being disposing of our septic. And we would rotate that throughout the year as need required. We would have to do a little bit of site work to have a good level area for the tanks. The tanks would be loaded and offloaded by the lightweight. They would return to Juneau. Then they would be pumped off of the lightweight. And the quote I got was 90 cents a gallon, which is the rate that is currently being charged by Juneau Septic, although they expect that cost will probably go up this summer. You can see the proposal. These are just rough numbers to give us an idea of what this could look like in terms of options. One of our operating options would be to utilize a third party. Joe's Tanks and Tank Farm would operate the business, and we would just set up the tank site and coordinate the shipping to Juneau. Another option would be a public-private partnership where we would do some investment, look at it in terms of startup money to help a third party then provide the service. Obviously, that would be a business, and the third party would need to cover costs and make a profit. Those variables make it difficult to determine what the price per gallon or the pumping service would be. And then the third option would be to operate it out of the city, utilizing, say, the temporary workers at the DRC. Yes, we have to look at getting somebody qualified CDL license, maybe a hazard materials endorsement, so some of the regulatory requirements. But we could purchase a pump truck, use pump trucks running anywhere from 30 to 150,000. We'd have to get the tanks, and we would have to also pay the operator. We could recover this with a surcharge or a fee to the service that would help us over time recover cost of repairs, servicing of the truck, wages, and other operational costs. But it gives us an opportunity to handle this within Gustavus and utilize the lightweight for transportation. Each one of those scenarios are covered in this proposal. There are other options available. This clearly is not exhaustive, but it's a starting point. I think that as a community member and listening to some of the stories of how people are dealing with their wastewater when they can't get pumped is somewhat alarming. Folks are having to resort to what I would consider pretty drastic measures, you know, digging holes on their property and moving their wastewater into one of the holes. Clearly that has limited area for most property owners. We have high water tables, so just the thought of it is concerning. We have PFAS, we have neighbors. I'm not sure I'd be too excited about someone having to do that kind of an operation next to me. And then we also have, you know, people who are surface spreading. I was told of an example of someone who was desperate had someone local pump the their septic and was charged $3,500. You know, that's an outrageous amount of money, but limited alternatives. So we have several folks were on the list last year to get pumped. We know that we're going to have folks coming up on this rotation that are planning to get their septics pumped. We're clearly growing given the census numbers. So it seems that we should at least try to identify some alternatives for handling our wastewater. I'm open to any suggestions for additional research. I'm hoping that this can generate a discussion. And with that, you know, I'd ask if any council members have any comments, questions, suggestions, next steps, any and all of the above.
Before I comment on this, any of the rest of you have any questions on this issue? It's an important and not an easy one to deal with. I'm not seeing any hands raised on the screen. For a little background, oh, Joe, okay. Let's hear from Joe Vanderzanden.
Tom, I was wondering that tank that used to sit down at the by the boat launch there, do you know whatever became of that? Is that one that Paul owned or one that was just here and he pumped out of, or did he pick it up and transfer it? I know he's limited to about 1,000 gallons or so on the forklift, but I wondered if you knew any background on.
Yeah, thanks, Joe. That's a good question. That's a good point. Folks may remember when we used to, before the ferry started servicing Gustavus, we used to take our wastewater and put it in a storage tank down the Salmon River Boat Harbor, and then the lightweight would come and pump it onto their boat and then take it to Juneau. I've asked around if anybody knew where that tank was, and nobody had a good answer. So unfortunately, I don't know. And that's why I was looking at some of these other tanks, or actually I was provided with those tanks as examples. But no, Joe, I don't appreciate the question though.
Any other council ideas, questions on this yet? Well, I'll, since I've been around here for quite a while, I can, oh, Tanya, go ahead, Tanya.
Sorry. I guess I'm just wondering where, I understand that there's a few people that, you know, in your examples, Tom, but has there been public outcry for this? I mean, it would be a huge undertaking, you know, taking on basically a utility. And this is kind of the first, you know, I was here way before the ferry and people had septic issues there. It seems like since the ferry even exists and comes here, you know, that's just been a huge plus. So I'm just wondering if there's been a lot of people clamoring for this. Does anyone know? And is that a new thing? Thanks.
Thanks for the question, Tanya. So in talking with Juneau Septic, initially I contacted them because I had received two or three calls about if I knew when the septic people were going to be coming to Juneau. And it took quite a while to get a hold of Juneau Septic. As you may know, the business is up for sale. They're under relatively new ownership, and it just became more than they were interested in dealing with. So I finally did get in contact with them. And he explained the problems they were having getting their truck on the ferry for different reasons, and their difficulty in getting to our region. It's not just us, but Elfin Cove and other the mines, the other remote areas. There's actually two service providers. One doesn't come up here. They just stick with the mines and Upper Lynn Canal, and Juneau Septic seems to be the one that has the services in our area. He told me that there were quite a few people that were still on the list from last summer. He thought that was around 10 to 12. And he also said that typically they'll get double that throughout the year. So I'm guessing in a year's time, based on that, we're looking at an average maybe of 20 people per year that have been getting their wastewater taken care of. My concern would be the issue of the how much they're able to take at any one trip, and how many trips are they able to take during the summer, because he says he won't come up here once the weather turns. He's done that before and had his truck stock. So once the rains come and the snow falls, and, he says he's just not going to risk getting his truck stuck out here for some time period. So I don't know what the key number is for significance, but I can only imagine that if you're in one of those situations where you needed your septic pump last summer and you're still waiting, if you've experienced any of those backups, you can see how desperate some folks might get. I hope that answered the question, Tanya.
Yes, thank you.
Thanks, Tom. I'd note also that the city actually has two vault toilets now in our park, and plus City Hall and other sites that have septic requirements too. So, and then there are a number of businesses that have them. So it's residents, it's businesses, it's city facilities. The community is growing. We looked into this about 10 years ago at a time when there wasn't any septic service and the ferry was just starting up at that point. And we, at that time, the two septic pumping services in Juneau seemed not to be interested in coming over here very much for the kinds of problems that Tom's mentioned, that scheduling their truck over here, the amount of time it takes, and they certainly can't make the kind of money they can if they're doing a bunch of tanks a day in Juneau or something with that truck. So we formed a septage committee, and I was on it, Greg Strebler, I can't remember who all else was, but we spent quite a bit of time charting out options, and it's fairly complicated. Like if you get into where can you land spread, if that's what you wanted to do, you get into issues with DOT and the distance from the airport, because they interpret sewage as being included in the limitations of for solid waste disposal within 10,000 feet of the runway. I don't think that FAA's regulation actually included septage in that, but DOT, the state, was fairly insistent about it. So that cut out a lot of Gustavus for land spreading. So it's fairly complicated. And I think this is something we need a subcommittee of the council to look into and try to come up with some options, thinking into the future, not just what our needs are now, but they're going to get to be more and more. And as we have more people, we have more potential for groundwater pollution and even odor issues and so forth from failed septic tanks. So it's something we need to take a look at. We were saved last time because Juno Septics decided that they would service Gustavus, but maybe with the growth here and changes in their business, they no longer see it as being something they can do all the time. Although I think they just renewed their business license over here in case they, so there may be some hope that they'll come and do a few tanks this summer, but that's not going to solve this for the long term. So I would like, if there's some council members who want to dig into this important issue, which really does have impact on our the future of the community, then how about letting me know and we'll see if we can put together a subcommittee that could review what the various business models might be. Some would, you know, from some entirely privately operated business model to something that might be a new function that the city does, which means the city has to take that as an authority and probably has to gear up with equipment and staff to do it, which has its impact on the overall size of the city operation that a lot of people are concerned about. So there are a range of possibilities here, and they all have pluses and minuses. So I hope some of you would let me know if you're interested in dealing with this, you know, trying to find some solutions on this, and you could be the heroes for the community, I think. Any other comments on this from council members? And then we can go back to Tom for the rest of his report. Okay, I don't see anything else. Tom, I think you had some other items.
Yes, thanks, Mayor. And thank you, everybody, for considering this issue. COVID testing. You might remember the updates that we've been providing, stating that the funding, excuse me, for our PCR and our rapid testing had end times. Well, the state notified us that they were going to terminate the PCR testing early, end of January. So we've worked up our alternative to the state funding through through the city funding the both PCR and rapids testing. So starting in February, we'll be running testing three times a week, 3 hours a day. The fire chief is working on determining which days, trying to work around ferry landings. Of course, the dates are flexible, so as need changes, so can the testing days. We've reduced our testers to one tester and then having the fire chief as a backup. We'll be submitting a NCO to get the funding in place so that we can start picking this up and continuing our testing program. Another update is with our FEMA grant applications. In addition to the FEMA application the mayor and I have been working on for the flood disaster reimbursement to all the roads work we've been doing, the mayor and I are also working on, and also with the assistance of Todd Boris, on a state disaster grant that will provide for funding for a hydrology and hydrologic study that will assist us for not only future grants, but give us a good idea of how water flows in Gustavus. Initially, we had projects identified for this program. However, we were informed that those projects would require this hydrologic and hydrology study. And the timeline for a project could take up to 2 years, and there's a lot of hoops to jump through. Since the hydrologic and hydrology study was required, they have a program where this can be fast-tracked and can be done without a lot of the same complications that the projects for roads and culverts would have taken. So we are moving in that direction. We hope to have an application in by the end of the month. If we are able to get that grant, then we should see the study being conducted toward the end of the summer. And then hopefully with the results before the rainy season and the winter hits us at the end of the year. In case you haven't heard, we do have a ferry update. As you know, the LeConte will be going to the yards here shortly. We're already not receiving any more ferry service from the LeConte. However, contacted the deputy commissioner at Marine Highways, and he informed us that the Taslina is being fitted to put back into service. You may remember that the Taslina serviced us when we had this issue previously. So the Taslina will be back online early February and should run until the Conti is back in service. Currently, that's looking like scheduled March 24th. So if it does come in on March 24th, we'll be able to go back to our regular LeConte service. Otherwise, the Taslina will stay online until the LeConte returns. That's all I have, Mayor, unless there's questions.
Well, one item we were going to talk about was the Marine Facility Use Agreement, Tom.
Yes, Mayor, I'm sorry. I thought you said we were going to talk about that at the end of toward the end of the meeting.
I guess it actually could have. I was thinking we could. Yeah, maybe what we'll do is we'll pick that up in as we go through the general meeting agenda, because it would fit into that. It'd be something we would put on the general meeting agenda for a motion somewhere around, I think it was item 9 or something on that. So let's remember to come back to the Marine Facilities Use Agreement that I think we've got sent out to everybody to look at. It was developed after Wednesday or starting on Wednesday, so we didn't have it in the original packet going out for this. So let me get back to my agenda here. I think, go ahead.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
Where did I see a hand up for Tanya. Tanya, did you have something you wanted to say at this point?
Yeah, thanks. I have a question for Tom about the COVID testing. That's great that we're going to continue to offer that. I just wanted to understand where the money's coming from. It looks like it says $900, but that's not going to cover 9 hours a week until July. So where's the rest of the money coming from to pay for that 9 hours a week tester?
Yep, thank you. Right, so the 900 isn't until the first of the year or the fiscal year. So what we'll be doing is we'll be doing an NCO, transferring the funds for the testing based on that $25 an hour, 3 hours a day, 3 days a week. And then we'll put in a little extra in case we hit any spikes where we do need to call in one of our other testers or to account for anything unexpected. whether that be in materials or in if we have an outbreak here and we need to do additional testing that can't be handled by just the one tester. So yeah, we'll have that on the NCO in the February, introduced in the February meeting, passed in the March meeting.
So the city will be paying for all of it without, there's not really a chance of getting reimbursed by anyone at this point?
Yep, that's correct. We thought because of the Omicron, we would the state would continue providing funding for the testing. But in speaking with them, you know, they have the at-home testing kits that are supposed to be coming out. We're trying to acquire some of those. Currently, the fire chief is has reached out and is on the list. And so the state said, yeah, they were not going to get any additional funding for testing programs or any of the other COVID programs. As of now, that could all change, you know, if we get another variant that is threatening the state, and then the state comes out and provides another declaration and funding for it.
Great, thank you.
Okay, thanks. I think at this point we'll go to our general meeting agenda and go do a quick run through that. Well, some of the items we'll need to discuss at some length. So if you want to switch over to the general meeting agenda, if you're running that on your screen on the side. We'll have staff reports from the fire department, the city clerk, the city treasurer, and the city administrator, similar to information that he's just given us a heads up on. Then we have a consent agenda. And the first item six on that consent agenda, on the one I'm looking at least, yeah. Is City of Gustavus waives the right to file a protest of the new alcohol license application for the Sunnyside Market license. And I'd remind you that this item is a quasi-judicial hearing item. So we have to avoid ex parte discussions or investigations relating to that. So we can't be going out and asking people, what do you think about Sunnyside's liquor license or that sort of thing. So you can look at the materials in the packet, and then we can, if you have questions or think that there's some discussion that be needed before we take action on approving it, you can ask to remove that item from the consent agenda and move it to new business. But if you're fine with it, then we can leave it on the consent agenda. So those are our options. But just a reminder that it's a quasi-judicial item, and so we don't do ex parte discussions on it. Next item seven is the routine certificate of records destruction that our clerk does every month, keeping us up on our records retention program. And then the next item is introduction of an NCO for department budgets on for which will be go on for public hearing on February 14th. And I think our treasurer's in here and can give us a quick review of what's on that NCO. Madam Treasurer, please.
Well, good evening, everybody. Can you hear me?
We can.
Okay, so we are introducing this NCO to amend our expenses on the following items. This is for the fire department. So the fire department proposed to have two EMT classes. this will have an additional cost of $5,000. So we propose to amend the budget from $8,000 to $13,000. This is for the two classes. The next one is what the city administrator talked about our testers that the state stopped funding. So this will cost $5,400 more. So we are amending the budget, if passes, from $1,500 to $6,900. Then we have for our fire department proposed an additional for ambulance supplies that will cost $1,000. Changing the budget from $5,250 to $6,250. And last but not least, our city hall is in need of supplies at the end of this fiscal year, and we're proposing an additional $1,000, changing the budget from $2,000 to $3,000. And that's it.
Okay, Madam Treasurer, I suppose the obvious question from some council members will be, where does the money come from? I'm guessing that we have sufficient surplus in our revenues so far that we can allocate some of that to this expense. Is that correct?
Exactly.
Okay. If any of you have any questions, further questions on the details on this, by all means, stop in and visit the treasurer or call her, and I'm sure she can give you any more details.
I would love to.
Need. Okay. So we'll be introducing that and scheduling it for public hearing next month. So it gets introduced just merely as a consent agenda item, since it's just a routine introduction, but we'll have an opportunity for public hearing and discussion on that in February, on February 14th. We have an ordinance for public hearing providing for coming up that we introduced last month. It's another NCO, and this is FY22-10 NCO. And Madam Treasurer, do you want to give us a review on that one too? Can you do that? The other NCO that's up for actual, this is up for public hearing.
I would like Tom to give us an update.
Okay, thanks, Mayor. So we're adjusting our budget, as you indicated, to account for additional revenue that we've received. And that's what we're looking at in the income area, the first section of the NCO. And in the second, under the expenses, we're making some adjustments, as indicated there. I don't know that you need me to go through each line item again, but I'm happy to do so if necessary. We do have one change that needs to be made, and that's with the DRC payroll. We had a dollar amount calculation that was incorrect when we initially looked at the original budget. Some of the benefits and other deductions were made prior to the original budget. So we'll have an amendment drafted up that will correct that particular item. More specifically, I can give you an idea of what the error had to deal with. We likely what we did is we had the wages, taxes, and retirement contributions accidentally in the amended budget column. So we had the budget original budget short from what should be 103,691, and then as you can see, we only reflected it as 93,644. So we'll have an amendment for that particular line item for the general meeting. If there's any questions on that, happy to answer it.
I guess I may have missed it. Do you know about how much that line item is going to, it's going to increase. So how much is that line item going to go up in the amendment?
So the error was the starting point where we had the original budget. We had the DRC's budget listed at 93 when it actually should have been listed at 103,691. So that's where the change is going to take place. So the original budget will be higher, and the adjustment then will also change the amended budget. So instead of 101 in the or 103 in the amended, it'll go up, you know, another $5,000. So 98,391 will go into the 103,695 or whatever that was I quoted. And that will be the adjustment.
Okay, the I see the clerk has commented to me here. I'm looking at the original version on my computer, and the one she's got on the screen is will be the changed amount, if I understand correctly.
Correct.
So, okay. If anybody has any questions about that further, the staff's available to answer them. And so we'll have an amendment on that NCO to make that little adjustment. And let's see. Okay, this would probably be a good point for us to put in the Marine Facilities Use Agreement. This is something that we've talked about, and I guess we got it coming up on the screen, Karen. I've thrown her off the order here. Sorry about that. Just the background on it, we've discussed this a number of times, the issues with primarily the charter fishing operations, but not just entirely those folks, with behavior on our city float system that has been less than stellar at times, particularly with regard to feeding stellar sea lions, as it turns out, and then some other behavioral conflicts that have occurred between charter captains or between charter captains and members of the city staff or other users of the floats. And we've thought that the best way to deal with this was to have a contractual agreement with the charter operations that sets forth the expectations clearly for their operation on our floats. We note that, yes, they are public floats, but they are the property of the City of Gustavus. The City of Gustavus has proprietary jurisdiction over them, so can set rules for use of them. And their use, their business use of our floats is reasonably dependent on their meeting the expectations for behavior that the owner of the float set. So, and we're not trying to be overbearing on anything, but essentially asking them to follow the requirements of the law, particularly with regard to incidental or direct feeding of sea lions, and also for just general behavior on the float. So we've drafted up this agreement, and we think it's important, and I thank Jim Muscoviac for his assistance on getting this worked up, and also Tom Williams. Between the three of us, we kind of put it together. So this is the agreement that we would intend to use with all the charter operators, and we can use it with other commercial operators on the floats as well. It also sets some standards even for the small boat harbor. They can't be leaving trash or food waste out where bears can get it, and they are not allowed to toss it into the river and that sort of thing to attract that, where it might attract bears or other wildlife, even feeding birds. So we put those requirements into there, and we would adopt this or approve it this month for application this year. And that way we can get this out to the charter operators and other commercial users of our float system and our marine facilities in plenty of time for them to be planning on this as an expectation for how they will operate, you know, this next summer. It gives them plenty of time to, if they need to adjust anything or figure out how they want to train their operators, these things will, they'll have this available once we approve it and then send it out as a notice. So I don't know if you've had an opportunity to read through it yet, or and do any of you have any questions about this way forward, council members? Okay, I'm not seeing any now, but if as you study through it and you see anything that we need to change, then we can certainly include that. And by the way, we'll do this by motion, approve it by motion. And I don't have in mind doing a resolution for it. It just approves the administration here, its use of this agreement and gives the stamp of approval of the council to it. But I would expect that we include in the motion that the administration has the approval to do minor edits on it as necessary to address any issues that come up or any improvements that we think of as we begin to implement it. So, and we've had I think we may actually have some things that we would want to change as we implement it. So if there are no other questions, then that's what that one's about. So one more opportunity. Does anybody want to ask about it, or please read through it and be ready to act on it at the meeting, and we'll vote on whether it's the will of the council to put this into use. Okay, then we move on to new business. Item 10 here, the mask wearing in city facilities. And that's a resolution that I've written up, and we've routed it to you already. Had very supportive comments come back to me from a number of you on it. suggestion from Tanya to add one item to the list of items that, I mean, the list of considerations that we would apply to adjusting to include the city of Juneau, what their alert level is, as well as our local census district. So I think we can easily add that. I don't think I probably don't need to read through this or anything at this point, but do some of you have any thoughts about this? We'll have it on the agenda. I think you're all aware that this was partly triggered by a meeting that we had with the staff where we've discussed how the process used by department heads to set standards or expectations for mask wearing during the pandemic in their facilities, how that's worked out. And they there had been indications from the staff that they're dealing with a number of, they've been somewhat stressed at times by having to explain their expectations of their department to the public. And the public has also suggested that we ought to have a couple of things. One, that we should have a uniform policy across all the city's facilities, rather than have the possibility of varying expectations depending on whether you're in the library or the DRC or the fire hall or the community chest, that we have a more uniform process, and also that we have some indication of how we're going to make sure this is not just an open-ended and it's going to be here forever, but how we will decide when we need to modify it, or we hope before too long be able to do away with it. So we included in the now therefore be it resolved at the end a list of considerations that may lead us or that may inform our decision each month on whether to keep moving it forward. And there's also the requirement that the mayor will report to the council every month with a risk assessment and any recommendations for changing this. So I hope that by adopting this resolution, we'll be able to set a more clear, uniform process or standard for mask wearing during the pandemic, and have a more clear set of means of considering how and when we should change or eliminate that requirement. So I guess I've kind of rambled on this. I'm sorry, but do any of you have any comments on it at this time? Joe Vanderzanden.
Yeah, I had some concerns about this in the previous resolution of 2107. It said the council through the mayor will give discretion to the city departments. In this one, the council isn't mentioned at all until the very last sentence. And then it says they can repeal this if they can determine that the risk of transmission is sufficiently low. I just didn't see how that was ever going to happen. It seemed like there'd just be another private meeting with the city staff. And if anybody's uncomfortable with it, then it'll just continue on indefinitely. And we're just kind of right back to our guidelines being based on comfort levels of individuals. I don't have anything else to say about that. My concern right now is library policy of requiring masking for kids. I mean, they're in school all day together without masks unless their parents have them wear them. And then they go over to the library after school, and kids all the way down to age 3, as I understand it, are required to wear masks. And It just seems excessive to me, but I don't see any way forward to do anything about it. Or I don't even know if anybody else shares my opinion, but it's just kind of stuck in the mud there, and I don't know where to go from there. That's it. Thank you.
Thanks, Joe. And by the way, I'm glad you mentioned that. I think it was paragraph 5 in CY 2107, in which we say that council or through the mayor allows the departments to set those standards in for their department. And I am wondering if it had occurred to me that we might put a sentence or a phrase in this before this next Wednesday, before it goes into the packet, that says that this modifies that direction in CY 2107, paragraph 5, or as I recall it was. So that would get rid of a possible conflict between the two resolutions. This would update that resolution, but wouldn't change anything else in it. I do understand your concern about whether this is still too open-ended. And I guess my answer to that is that we still don't know what the direction of the pandemic is going to be. We're hopeful that we're going to see a peak, perhaps the end of this month or early next month, and a decline, and that with Omicron, we may be moving in the direction of this becoming more an epidemic, with a virus that is endemic in the global population. And at that point, that's probably going to suggest that that we are going to be treating this more like we do flu and other viruses that are prevalent in our population. So, but we just don't know what the change, you know, how the pandemic is going to play out over the coming weeks. And so I would like to keep monitoring it. I am interested in, and I think most of the staff is, you know, doesn't really want to keep masks on everybody forever. And, but we need to be looking at how the risk changes and then make our judgment of when to or how to adjust the policy or eliminate it based on the change in the risk assessment. So I'll have to ask you to try it out with me, and I'll try to give you a report each month that goes through the kinds of points that we listed in the now therefore be it resolved paragraph, and you can evaluate how that's going. And if it's not working, and it's not appearing flexible enough, or we're not paying close attention to the actual changes in risk, then the council can certainly bring that forward and bring about a change to it. So that may sound a little vague, but I don't know how to be more. We can't say this is going to all go away on March 1st, much as we might like it to. So that's my somewhat rambling response to that. Tanya?
Yeah, thanks. I think this resolution is a huge improvement over the last one. And a big part of it is because it actually takes the rationale for the masks off of city staff and volunteers and explains a lot of the other aspects to it. CDC, Alaska Department of Health and Social Services recommendations, you know, the pandemic alert, you know, there's all sorts of agencies and organizations recommending masks right now. And so, you know, basically this isn't, the way I see it is it's the exact opposite of saying the staff will decide. But at the same time, we know the staff supports this. So that's huge too. So basically it just, in my mind, builds a much better rationale for a mask policy right now. And yeah, part of me wishes there was a date. And I think probably a lot of people in the community would feel that way, that a date, you know, having this open-ended thing is, it might be, you know, less sure that, or just less sure. But I think actually, I agree with you, Mike, that, you know, if we can talk about it every single month, and, you know, it's actually more flexible, and the policy can change quicker if there's not a date set. And I really like your number seven, how we would determine, and what we would talk about. I mean, I think that's a huge improvement of when we would decide to, change the mask mandate. It's clear, it's transparent, and maybe even a next step would be to, you know, make some sort of chart that we, you know, publish every month, as to where we're at with all these different metrics. And I'd be happy to help with that. So I like it. I appreciate it. And I know there's going to be a lot of people that don't, because they don't want to mask. But we do have, you know, if we don't require masks, and, you know, if we go against the policies of basically all the health organizations in the country, state, and world, and someone, you know, contracts COVID on in our building and gets really ill, you know, we are liable for that. We have a responsibility to go with the public health mandates. So I like that this resolution clearly articulates that. Thank you.
Thank you. You said that better than I did. I appreciate that. And yeah, I note that one thing I didn't list in these bullet points was considering the transmission factor, R sub T, that many of you are probably familiar with. As of last week, the statewide transmission factor was 1.64. If it got down to one and stayed below one for a continuous period of time, that might be the kind of thing that CDC and the State Department of Health and Social Services would, that would lead them perhaps to declare that the pandemic had ended and that it was now merely an endemic problem. And it's, we're not getting, every infected person is infecting less than one other person, which means that, that the pandemic sort of tapers off. We're not there yet, but that's one of the kinds of, that's one of the metrics that would be involved in this. And of course, we'll pay attention to what the staff has to say. Jim Muscoviac, your thoughts.
Well, I just want to say that I totally agree with everything that Tanya said, and I won't have to repeat it. And yeah, it was good. Thank you.
Okay, thanks. Any other questions on this? And if any of you want to check in with me during the week, well, I guess send your question or comment to the clerk. Maybe that's the best way to do it. And I can, we'll figure out a way to respond or address them that doesn't violate the Open Meetings Act. Any other comments? Okay. The next is, next new business item was 11 on the agenda, and that's CY22-XX, the number's not applied yet. Certifying the annual certified financial statement of revenues and authorized expenditures for the year ending June 30. And this, Madam Treasurer, you, I guess she's not, doesn't have a comment yet on that. Does anybody have any questions on this? This is something, as I recall, we do every year. We just have to certify that our financial statement is what it is. And this is our official certification by the City Council that that our financial statement for the last year is complete and accepted. So I think that's my about the best explanation I can give on that one. Any other questions? Okay. The next one is CY22XX, submission of capital projects and information system to the Alaska legislature. And if you click on that, you'll see what the resolution is. And Tom, is this something that you'd like to hold forth on? I think you've had more to do with this than I have.
Okay, thank you, Mayor. Yeah, this is the CAPS. It's the State Capital Projects and Information Systems funding program that in the past has been very helpful to small communities in that the state would fund priority projects, one, two, or three projects because small communities just didn't have the funding to be able to do it. However, recently, or over the last several years, the state has not been funding any of these projects, but we have still been submitting our CAPSIS requests. And that's what this is. It's one we do every year. We need to get them out in February. There's a deadline for the state to receive them. And what we've done is taken we reached out to the departments to see if there's any changes in priorities or projects. And then we incorporate it into the existing CAPS, and that's the red lines. You can see some projects have already been completed, like the recycling center, and then some have been modified, like the fire truck. There's no funding requirements in the submission. It's a wish list, if you will. And then any new projects would need to have a scoping document approved by the council so that if a project is approved, we have the authority to fund that projects. And in this case, we have one that's changed. And so the scoping document will just be changed to reflect the type of truck. That's pretty much it in a nutshell. Is there any questions?
Thanks. Any questions for Tom on this request for the funding from the legislature? There may be some hope that we'd actually get some funding. We haven't had, I think the last project that we got funded was the bridge on Good River Road, where we removed a culvert there and where the Harry Hall Creek crosses under Good River Road. So that was like about 2017. And I don't think there'd been much in the way of CAPSIS, CIP funding available from the legislature since then, but the situation may be improving. And as long as we keep putting these things out, then the legislature sort of knows we've been asking for them for a number of years, and eventually maybe they'll come through for us. So we'll see. Okay, I think that's the last of our items on the general agenda. And do any council members have anything else they'd like to bring up in the work session here? I'm not seeing any hands coming up, so thank you all for attending, and we'll have our general meeting next Monday night. We hope everybody is staying safe with this big snow dump that we've had, and so take care of your homes, your roofs, your families, your cars, and all that, and we'll see you next Monday. Thanks a lot. Bye.